This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. This show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and frameworks the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text or an idea we hope will shed light on the world around you. Today, we're going to explore the world of India, and to help us walk through the many texts that grapple with Indian reality is Bonojit Hussain. He's a founding member of the New Socialist Initiative. He is Delhi-based but comes from the state of Assam. Thanks, Bonojit, for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah, because friends call you Bono, do they?
Yeah.
They call me Bono. Okay, not to be mistaken for that. Is that a joke that is often told?
Yeah.
It's too much. Okay. So much for originality. Okay, so Bonojit, could we begin with where you're from? Because in many ways, I guess Malaysians, whether they're of South Asian origin or not, know the capital cities of India, you know, and they also know Tamil Nadu because many people are of Tamil extraction, yeah. Or they know Kerala or all those various states their ancestors came from. But you come from a place that perhaps is less familiar to a Malaysian, and that is the state of Assam. Where is Assam?
Yeah, I was kind of born and brought up in Assam, and Assam is in the northeastern part of India. Actually, if you look at the map of India, it's not really northeast, but the British called it northeast because they were looking at that region from the Bay of Bengal. So from Bay of Bengal, it's actually northeast. It's not northeast from Delhi. So if you're familiar with the map of India, towards the east, you will see a chicken neck, which connects the rest of India to a region which borders Bhutan, Burma, and Bangladesh. So the region has seven states, Assam being the largest in terms of population. Then you have Arunachal Pradesh, which borders Tibet, which is largest in terms of area, but the kind of smallest in terms of population. Then you have the state of Meghalaya, Nagaland, Mizoram, Manipur, and Tripura. You mentioned that not many people in Malaysia would be familiar with this region, but the reality is that even within India, not too many people really know about the Northeast.
How is that possible?
There's a long history to it. They know it on the map, but it's almost a kind of black hole in the Indian imagination. They don't know the people who live in that area. It has a colonial legacy also because the British kind of really had a very, very orientalist, white man's burden approach to the Northeast because culturally, the northeastern part is quite different from rest of India. It's closer to, let's say, mainland Southeast Asia. And it's inhabited by around 220, some call them tribes, some call them nationalities, some call them ethnicities. It depends from what perspective you're looking at it. It's not there in the textbooks, the history of Northeast, because the British saw people in the Northeast to be people without history because culturally they were very different. They were tribes.
Are they also like mostly Hindu?
Not really. I mean, if we look at the demographic, now it would be around, let's say, roughly equal population of Hindus, Muslims, and Christians.
And some of those states are actually predominantly Christian.
Predominantly Christians, yeah. Like Meghalaya would be like, yeah, maybe 95% Christian. Nagaland and Mizoram. Nagaland would be like, yeah, almost Christian, maybe 99% or something. Manipur, it must be around 50-50 between Hindus and Christians and a small population of Muslims. Mizoram, it's very interesting that it's predominantly Christian, but you also have a significant Jewish population.
Oh, okay. I mean, I think one of the things, because with India is one is always impressed by diversity. Yeah. It's the diversity, it's not just the languages, it's the way people look. It is, I mean, everybody in Malaysia could potentially be Indian. I mean, yeah. In an Indian context,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Whether you're Chinese or Malay or whatever, if you walked and you didn't say anything, people could assume you were from some part of India. You talked about colonial policy and the colonial imaginary in terms of how it organized or saw people, right? But why did the Indian independent state... Yeah. I mean, colonialism, you know, lapsed in 1947.
47, yeah.
Right? So India's had a long history of independence. Why didn't the new state of India correct these views? Or was there a lot of continuity in the way that the British administered the state and how, you know, Indian administrators also?
Actually, there's a lot of continuity in the sense... Because I forgot to mention that the British saw the Northeast as, being inhabited by people without history because the local culture were out of this quote-unquote Indic civilizational culture. So that kind of difference continued even after independence. Also, another reason is that the region is very strategically, quote-unquote, strategically located. China is right there above Northeast. Then, of course, you have the partition. So you have Bangladesh, East Pakistan at the time, just below the Northeast. On the eastern frontier, you have Burma. And in fact, there were, even in 47, like if we talk about the Nagas who live in Nagaland, at the time, it was part of Assam in 47. It was called the Hills District of Assam. The Nagas, in fact, declared independence a day before India.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Okay.
So they sent a letter to UN declaring that they are a different nation. And in fact, Gandhiji had a very interesting take on Nagaland. He said that if the Nagas want to be a separate nation, then they should be allowed to be a separate nation. And if India wants to forcefully take over Nagaland, then they have to walk over my dead body. That was Gandhi in 47, actually.
Clearly, his wishes were not respected.
Not respected, definitely. I mean, because it's also like modern boundary border drawing, because there's a huge number of Naga population on the other side in Burma. So what happened was that in pre-colonial times, this region was not a periphery. This region was a melting point of, you know, different currents of migration, trade. It was on the Eastern Silk Road. And with the advent of modern nation state, the borders were drawn, and from being a melting point, from being a center of fusion, it became a periphery. And so for various reasons, for security reasons, quote-unquote security reasons, strategic reasons, Delhi has always seen the region from that security and strategic viewpoint. So there has not been much attempt from the larger Indian society to actually understand this region. It has always been a strategic and security perspective which was in play.
You know, I want to come back to a point you made about this notion of the Indic civilization, because it seems to be in contemporary political discourse, again, an important way of framing what is India, who is the Indian. And, you know, and Hindu nationalism, I think, in its attempts to kind of shore up its ideological grip on the population, talks about history quite a bit,
yeah.
You know, and in the idea. So could you maybe explain what is it that is meant by Indic civilization and who would fall out of it, even within the context of India?
Indic civilization, as described by the British and... British draws a lot from, you know, ancient travelers like Ptolemy and all. So it's Indic civilization. It's mostly like ancient Vedic civilization they talk about. Geographically, the Northeast is obviously out of Indic civilization. It was much more closer to Southeast Asia and But within the main, I mean, in Northeast, we call rest of India the mainland India, even though it's connected by land. But
you see yourselves as an island, do you?
Yeah. So if I may use the word, even in mainland India, who would be outside of quote-unquote Indic civilization? They would be the Adivasis, the indigenous forest dwellers. And even now in contemporary times, they have been extremely marginalized, and now they are being pushed away from the central Indian forest because it's very rich in mineral resources. And
in fact, one of the books, and we want to talk about books today, but you know, we haven't actually begun.
Yeah.
But Arundhati Roy, who's one of the authors on our list, has a book called Walking with the Comrades, when she talks about, I think, this particular group of tribals who are caught up in the disputes over land, attempts to take over their land for mining purposes and such, right? Walking with the Comrades. So so back to the Indic civilization. So Adivasis are outside of Indic civilization. Who else?
Now, I mean, you mentioned the Hindutva right wing. For them now, they would try and argue that the religious minorities are out of Indic civilization. So, in fact, there is this argument from the right wing that the argument goes like this, that everyone is Hindu. Hinduism is not a religion, it's a way of life. And some of the ideologues have gone to the extent that they've said that Hindu is actually a race. So the religious minorities were, you know, converted to different religions in some point of history, but essentially they are Hindu. So if they want to remain in India, they should revert back to Hinduism. So in a way, in contemporary India, the right-wing vision of right-wing vision of Indic civilization, the religious minorities are excluded.
Okay, so religious minorities would be Jews, Christians, and then we have Muslims.
Muslims.
And Muslims are huge as a community. And not only that, you had India had, because you're not from the mainland, from mainland India. So mainland India had Muslim emperors. So the Mughals were there for hundreds of years. So the idea that Muslim civilization in India, as expressed in Indian terms, as it were, is somehow not Indic is a curious one to make, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's absolute rewriting of history according to their own political kind of goals. Because if we look at the Mughal history, it's not about religion. Absolutely not about religion. Some of the amazing translations of Vedic literature were commissioned by the Mughal emperors. In fact, Akbar tried to come up with a syncretic religion called Din-e-Ilahi, which was basically, it borrowed important tenets from Hinduism and Islam. And I mean, these things are not talked about anymore, that you had a Mughal emperor who actually tried to come up with a religion according to the ground realities of India.
Okay, before we end, just a very quick note, and then it will signal part two when we're going to talk about books, to connect Island Assam with the mainland India is a book that we talked about even before the show, which is Highway 39. Could you very quickly tell us, what is Highway 39?
Okay, Highway 39 is actually a very interesting book. It's one of the few books, if not the only, which is not voyeuristic in its nature, because anything that is written about Northeast is, you know, this exotic Northeast inhabited by tribals, very colorful dance and stuff like that, nothing more. Highway 39 is an actual highway, which starts from Assam and it traverses through Nagaland, then Manipur, and then goes into Burma. So the author actually travels through this highway and he narrates the story of the political conflict and subjugation and Indian states' responses to different conflicts in the region through different encounters with people that inhabit this. So Highway 39 in a way is a metaphor.
Wonderful. On that note, we'll stop and we'll come back with more about Sudip Chakravarti's Highway 39 and the many other books that we hope will help you kind of explore India, whether it's virtually or in your living room or, you know, as a kind of preface to actually traveling to that country. You've been listening to Bonajit Hussain. He is a founder member of the New Socialist Initiative. He's New Delhi based and, of course, myself, Sharad Kutit. You're listening to Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, and Night School continues. We have as our guest today Bonajit Hussain. He's a founder member of the New Socialist Initiative. You're based in New Delhi, but you come from Assam, which is a state within the Federation of India. It's a union, right? India is a union of states. Yeah. And as you described it before, people from Assam see the other part of India as mainland. So we're going to be talking about mainland India and this island of the Northeast. And we ended part one by referring to a book by Sudip Chakravarti called Highway 39. And you said this was an attempt to kind of understand that region through travel. Yeah. You know, and encounters with people. And so what is it that Sudip learns on this journey?
Well, he discovers different stories of apathy from New Delhi and how the kind of responses from Delhi to any issues that arise in Northeast has always been a militaristic response of counterinsurgency and security. And so in a way, he discovers the massive story of misgovernance by Indian state in Northeast.
The discovery of India, of course, is the title of Jawaharlal Nehru's first Prime Minister of India, and his book. So I guess Indians have always... Or is it a contemporary Indian thing to kind of go out and discover your own country?
Well, I would say that lots of people take India for granted because of how Indian nationalism has been framed. I mean, after all, nationalism, as Benedict Anderson says, is an imagined community. It's a supra-geographical imagination. So the dominant discourse on nationalism often blinds people and leads them to take many things for granted.
Okay, so we've traveled on Highway 39 from Assam to perhaps the capital. Let's start with the capital. We have, in fact, two books to talk about that come from the capital of India, New Delhi. It's a place I visited for the first time this year. And while I visited, I did, in fact, meet Rana Dasgupta, who's the author of a new book on Delhi called Capital. But I had many years ago read a book by Kushwant Singh called Delhi.
Yeah.
Which is actually quite interesting. It's kind of a fictionalized history of the city, both ancient and modern. And he kind of works back and forth. Kushwant Singh, of course, is famous for many things, one of them being joke book.
Jokes,
And I think he's still alive. He's in his 90s. But then, of course, he's got some other serious books like Train to Pakistan and Delhi, which is kind of ribald and very very earthy in its humor, right?
Yeah.
So the two books that you've chosen to talk about in terms of Delhi are?
One book is called Free Man, written by the senior journalist named Aman Sethi. It's a kind of compelling story of an individual and a group of people who actually move the city, who run the city. These are the marginalized manual laborers coming from different parts of the country, and their stories never find a place in the narrative of the city. They are always kind of explained away in statistics. So Aman Sethi, kind of through the story of a 40-something guy named Mohammed Ashraf, who is a hard-drinking, pot-smoking house painter. So Sethi starts interacting with Mohammed Ashraf in 2005, and over 5 years, Mohammed Ashraf and Sethi has this conversation. And through these conversations over 5 years, Sethi gets this kind of entry into the almost invisible world of workers, manual laborers, footloose proletariat, so to say, who actually runs the city. It's the book is kind of, it's called Freeman because the protagonist, Ashraf, he kind of offers deep insight into the struggles of everyday life and the solitude of urban poverty, but at the same time trapped by, you know, almost absolute powerlessness. Ashraf is adamant to exercise whatever little power he has. Ashraf would say to Seti that the owner owns my labor, but he doesn't own me. So that's a kind of very philosophical statement to come from a, we would imagine to come from a, you know, daily wage earner. So Ashraf would insist that freedom is very important, like the fine balance between wage and freedom. So he would, to prove his autonomy, he would choose work which allows him enough freedom to, you know, spend whatever little money he has on booze and pleasures and boiled eggs and beeries. And so it's actually a very gripping account of the invisibles in the city.
Now, you mentioned A Fine Balance because that's also the title of another book on India, isn't it? The thing is, there have been many stories about India from the ground up. In a sense, the invisibles have never been so silent, right? Because you've had, in popular and in international terms, you've had Slumdog Millionaire, you had Meera Nair's other classic about slum children. And in many, you know, I've even watched an art house Indian movie called Dobi Gat about a rat catcher in Mumbai with dreams of breaking into Bollywood. So that subject is not untouched. So, you know, is it important? I mean, if you're visiting India, kind of understanding this life, why would you think that a book like this is important to read?
It's I think it's important because you mentioned Slumdog Millionaire. It's, those stories are a bit exoticized. It's like, you know, rags to the riches kind of story. But actually, in Aman Sethi's book, the end doesn't, I mean, the book doesn't end in a rag to riches kind of.
It's not a fairy tale.
It's not a fairy tale. It's actually about the people. So, through Ashraf, he encounters a range of manual workers. He also, the book also discusses about their dreams. So, but the irony is that all their dreams are actually impractical because of the constraints of poverty, and they have their agencies. So they have, their life is, I mean, their life choices are quite strategic, but it's for survival. It's not for success. So within that kind of constraint, their dreams are almost fantastic. Like one of the workers in the book, he talks about this dream where he kind of imagines that he will start a pig farm. But the problem is that the land he's eyeing belongs to a Muslim businessman. So these dreams are a way of kind of relishing certain moments, but they are not realistic. They also know it, that these are not realistic, but these dreams are something which keeps them going. So it's, the book is not kind of a exoticization of poverty or anything. It's about the agency within the constraints they live within.
Now, you wanted to contrast this with Rana Dasgupta's book, Capital.
Yeah.
Which also consists of interviews, but with a very different class of Indians.
Yeah. So Rana Dasgupta's Capital, even though the book also explores the lives of drug dealers and manual laborers, and it talks about history of Delhi as well, the book is predominantly about how the rich lives in Delhi. So in last 20 years or so, especially since the opening up of the economy in 1992, Delhi has produced a huge number of millionaires which are not listed I mean, they don't want themselves to be listed. They think we don't need to show off by listing in some magazine or something. Capital by Rana Das Gupta is equally gripping account of Delhi, but it's on the other side of the spectrum. He encounters, again, this is also, the book is also a series of encounters with bureaucrats and, you know, billionaires. And usually it would be argued that, you know, capitalism is a superior system because it respects or it values talent and skills. But the billionaires in Rana Das Gupta's book, they amassed their capital or money through various means, like it's brute force, it's sheer luck, it's political connections. So it's basically cronyism, what it shows. Like there's one story I remember in the book about this young guy whose father was a small-time property dealer in late 80s. And with the real estate boom, his father was able to kind of buy up lots of land on the outskirts of Delhi and build huge like malls and kind of residential apartments and things like that. And they suddenly become very rich. And this young man was in his school and he was not interested in his studies. So he decides to go off to London for vacation, and the vacation lasted for 1 year. And he learned some kind of skills there, and he came back and kind of started working on his father's business. And in the interview with Rana Das Gupta, the author, this young man says that he's bought up 5,000 acres of land in Nigeria. I mean, not bought up, actually leased from Nigerian government. And how did he get that land? And he says that, oh, you know, there's this Russian billionaire who is a friend of my father, and the Russian billionaire is close to the Nigerian president. So we got the deal. And then he says, I'm thinking of, you know, taking 5,000 Punjabi farmers from Punjab there, because Punjabi farmers are not afraid of big farms. And we are going to start like technical schools there and teach the Nigerians how not to be afraid of big farms, and we'll take over Heinz in a few years. So that's the rich of Delhi.
And their fantasies.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things about real estate is quite interesting. And I there are two things. I mean, one is Khushwant Singh's forebears, I believe, were involved in the development of the new Delhi, you know, as opposed to the ancient Delhi. And that's where their wealth comes from. But in recent times, and I chanced upon a magazine of long-form essays called Caravan.
Caravan, yeah.
It's really very good.
Yeah, very good. Yeah.
Yeah, so kind of like telling the story, you know, it reminds me of Mike Davis and his work, City of Quartz, looking at Los Angeles. And so, you know, here, you know, is Mike Davis being a kind of Marxist geographer, telling a story about, you know, a city, but actually explicating the deeper dynamics of how, as you put it, how capitalism really works. It works through all these things, happenstance, connections, and such, right? So, okay, so we have a free man, we have capital. Where do we go to next?
We can actually look at Arundhati Roy's book, which is called Broken Republic. Broken Republic is basically a collection of three essays, and the longest and the most controversial essay is called Walking with the Comrades. The book talks about the situation in the central Indian forest, which is mostly inhabited by Adivasis, as we have already talked about. So there's been a kind of almost a civil war going on there, because the Maoists, the Naxalites, they are very strong there. Some people argue that the whole of central Indian forest is actually controlled by the Maoists. The government doesn't have any presence there. So the book actually takes us to the central Indian forest, about how the Adivasis know the Indian state. For the Adivasis, the Indian state is the local police who would you know, work with the forest contractors and to exploit the Adivasis. And also there has been, in last 15 years or so, because this area is very rich in minerals. So many of the large mining companies from across the world are actually eyeing this region. So the Maoist actually came into the picture not because the Adivasis are ideologically convinced about Maoism, but because the only form of Indian state the Adivasis have ever seen is repression, and the symbol of Indian state is the police. So the Maoist kind of enters into the picture as Robin Hood for the Adivasis. So it's not about ideology or anything that the Maoist, for the Adivasis, probably the Maoists are the only saviors. That's how they see them. So Arundhati Roy explores this region by going into the remote forest of Bastar in Chhattisgarh, and she interviews many Maoist cadres, and she lives with them for like a few weeks or so. Arundhati Roy, in the essay, she almost kind of, how do I say, I mean, she also romanticizes the Maoist. That part I won't agree with Arundhati, but it's a book worth reading because it takes you into a state of exception in Indian democracy. You have well-functioning democratic institutions and everything, but you have this huge pocket in central India where democracy doesn't exist. I mean, forget about democracy. The only face of Indian state is police repression.
You know, you use the phrase state of exception, and of course that echoes the theories of Agamben, I think, you know. So, but we're not going to be talking about Agamben and states of exception. But what it really interests me is that, okay, so we have, you know, you in particular have a view of India, right? And the books that you've chosen are quite critical. I mean, you know, there's a lot of hoopla in India. And it's the coming to power of Narendra Modi. It is the strength of this Hindu nationalist party, BJP, and the kind of stories they want to tell about India. These are not going to be the books that they would put on their must-read list, would it?
No.
I mean, how does one square the kind of critical tradition that Indians have developed, you know, around their own exercise of introspection, of intellectual introspection, against this kind of politics that people buy into in a big way of, you know, of celebrating India, of being proud of it, of talking about all its successes and saying, well, okay, yeah, we do have some problems. Everybody's got problems. You know, why? But why do you focus on the problems and not on the big story of success?
This kind of books are very important. It's you mentioned the tradition of, you know, criticality in India. I think these books are in that tradition because it punctures the false nationalist narrative that, you know, we have some problems, but India is a wonderful place. I mean, it's a wonderful place, but to make it more wonderful, you have to all the time talk about the problems.
Now, we're going to go back to Assam in a way by just mentioning the fact that you do are interested in the rising violence against Northeasterners in India. Could you tell us very briefly what's happening with that?
Well, there has been a rise of violence against Northeasterners in big cities in mainland India.
You can't see it, folks, but he's got air quotes going with that, mainland India.
Again, it's the kind of continuation of what I mentioned earlier, because what has happened is, as I mentioned earlier, that the Northeast is there in the minds of people just as a place on the map. As far as history and people is concerned, it's completely blank in the imagination. But because of various reasons, even though Northeast is very rich in minerals, we produce almost like maybe 60% of the oil in India. We produce around 70% of the gas, and tea. Tea is a big thing in India because, around 90% of India's tea is produced in Assam. Even though we are very rich in minerals, but nothing much has happened. I mean, there's no employment opportunity because of misgovernance and conflict, and Indian state has a big role to play in making the conflict more complex. So you have huge number of young men and women migrating to big cities for higher education, looking for employment opportunities. So in Delhi, the numbers have increased very rapidly over the last 10 years or so. I've been in Delhi for the last 15 years. I can tell you that now Northeastern people are very visible on the street, but they are not your regular Indian. They look like Chinese, they look like Burmese. So,
and I believe there's a pejorative term that's used against them.
Yeah, they are called the Chinkies. They're called the Chinkies. Northeastern women are seen as, loose and things like that, because most of the hill states, people are Christian, and they've been through Christian missionary, they've been exposed to Western culture, so they are quite liberal in dressing and other things, whereas the local society in places like Delhi is very conservative. So one thing is that you are absolutely not familiar with these people. So as long as Northeast stays on the map, that's fine. But when you encounter the people, you are clueless because you have no idea who peoples this region. So absolute cultural insensitivity. I mean, Northeastern people are seen as outsiders, and so there's lots of conflict arising where the Northeastern people in big cities are at the receiving end.
Right, and it turned to violence as well, and deadly violence.
Yeah, we have had, in Delhi itself, we have had around many incidents, but at least 4 young people have been killed in the last 1 year.
So I guess the critical tradition in Indian letters will have to address this question.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. Well, you know, I tell you, it's been fascinating. We're running out of time, but we can continue this conversation on our Facebook page. Are you on Facebook?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you can continue to speak to Bonajit about India. Maybe we can persuade him to give us a reading list. Either books or articles you think are essential to preface maybe even a trip to India. I think I'm fascinated to go on this Highway 39, especially because of its links to Burma. I think that would be, or Myanmar, as we call it. So, and also, are you on Twitter?
No, I'm not on Twitter.
Okay, you don't have Twitter, but I'm on Twitter, and it's at Sharad Kutin. You can tweet me if you have any questions you want to ask. And you can also send us an email, and we can forward it to Bonajit. It's bfmnightschool@gmail.com. So thank you very much, Bonajit, for joining me today on Night School.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's always a pleasure. I'm Sharad Kutin, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.